The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us. In their new book, The Hollow Parties, Daniel Schlossman and Sam Rosenfeld present a comprehensive history of the rise of American mass party politics in the Jacksonian era up through the years of Barack Obama to the presidency of Donald Trump. Eminent historian Michael Kazin calls the book the most sweeping and most incisive history of party organization I have ever read. Schlossman is an associate professor of political science at Johns Hopkins, where he studies social movements and political histories. He is the author of When Movements Anchor Parties, Electoral Alignments in American History. Sam Rosenfeld is the author of The Polarizers, Postwar Architects of Our Partisan Era. And he is an associate professor of political science at Colgate, where he researches party politics and American political development. This evening, Sam and Daniel will be in conversation with writer and state senator Nikhil Saval, author of the soon-to-be-published Rage in Harlem, June Jordan and Architecture. Please welcome our guests.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Andy, for that introduction. It's an honor to be back here at the Free Library with two colleagues or two friends, Sam Rosenfeld and Danny Schlossman, and to mark this really the publication of this fantastic and very sobering and incisive and I think quite brilliant book, The Hollow Parties, which I have been a Pennsylvania state senator for, this is now my fourth year. I've been involved in kind of local party politics since at least 2018. It was exceptional to read this book just to kind of reflect on that experience and to see where it came from. But, you know, I just want to start, you know, welcoming you with a question that I think we'll just get to the title itself. It's certainly since 2016, I'd say that we have been in an intensely, what everyone I think would describe as an intensely polarized, intensely partisan, intensely politicized time, right? Politics is taken very existentially. People seem very committed to it, people who are involved. It's every election seems like the most important election of our lifetimes, or it's certainly described as such. This November's election certainly being no exception, and yet we are, you know, we're also in a time of what is described as paralysis. Things seem adrift. You know, democracy is at threat, etc. And you describe this as, you know, at least in part, a major source of this is the state of our two major political parties, to which, as we've been describing, people seem very committed and are very involved in. And you describe this phenomenon as being a symptom of hollowness. And the two parties that, you know, despite all this activity and frenetic work that we're all doing, there's actually a fundamental hollowness at the project. And, it's surprising and interesting. And I'm curious if you could just kind of describe that. What does it mean? What's at stake? What's going on with the title?
Sure. And thanks for having us here. This is a real thrill. It's precisely that paradox of kind of frenetic and conflictual activity with a kind of deep incapacity that is what motivated us to start thinking about this metaphor of hollowness. I mean, polarization has, as you say, made the two parties much more ideologically sorted by identity. It's intensified people's identification with one side or the other. people's passions are stirred, mainly, we would argue, and political scientists would argue, in terms of negative feelings towards the other side more than a kind of positive sense of affinity to their own side. But parties are kind of central to American politics right now more than they have been in a long time, and yet, as organizations, as institutions, parties seem to be kind of not in control of their own destinies. When we say hollowness, we are trying to evoke a kind of incapacity to organize collective decision-making internally in the parties on things like nominations, but also sort of what your agenda for power is, what kind of priorities you're setting to shape that agenda, as well as incapacity to organize politics outside of the parties, just in the broader political landscape.
Sam talked about the first word of the title. I want to talk just briefly about the second, which is political parties. That what is a political party? We take E.E. Schatzschneider's classic definition from his book Party Government in 1942, that a party is an organized attempt to get control of the government. And why is that important? Because there are all these actors in politics who want something out of government, but only parties want to organize the government, want to actually say, we are a group that is controlling a ballot line, and once we've controlled that ballot line, we are going to seize control of the reins of power with it. And that is what makes parties interesting and distinct, in a sense, why, especially now, but in general, if you want to understand patterns of political conflict, you look to political parties.
And to be clear, sorry, Sam, go ahead. Yep.
Well, just observationally, what we see and think of as hollowness is in part, it's a kind of, we've got top-down organizations. National party organizations have a lot of capacity these days to do things like raise money. State and local party organizations in a lot of places have atrophied relatively. They're not rooted civic organizations in the way they have been in particular times in the past. And you've had the growth of these kind of para-party organizations, not part of the formal party entities, that have over time come more and more to kind of encroach upon the prerogatives and functions that have traditionally been the remit of the parties themselves.
So practically and experientially, their parties are doing certain things, right? They're raising money, they're winning elections, they're sometimes, you know, but in a just day-to-day experience, they're not rooted. They don't have fundamental commitments. There's no project at stake for either, and this is also, and we'll get into this. This is also not. This is in some ways unique. There have been times in the past when these parties have had projects and they've had commitments and the like. And I just want to be clear about the stakes of this, because you are also arguing that this isn't just like, the two major parties are in this situation. They're, you know, and oh well, right? This has fundamental explanatory power for the situation that we find ourselves in today. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that. And to do that, we want to think about the ways that hollowness, this distinctive combination of activity and incapacity, has manifested itself differently in the two parties. That for Democrats, it means since the 1970s, we can maybe talk more about why we think the 1970s are important, a party that is ineffectual, that has all these different actors in and outside of it, not working toward a common project, often at cross purposes, raising a lot of money, doing a lot of stuff, and yet much, much less in the sum of its parts. And for Republicans, it means a party that is very vulnerable to extremism, because the party story is a lack of party story, that the key actors are not political parties that are committed to the essential quality of party, understanding that your partial solution, that's the part of party, is not the whole, but wide open to extremism, led by non-party groups on the right that are the dominant features of national politics and that have been the key actors in creating our hollowed-out party system.
Yeah, I mean, there is a big Democratic doom literature out there that we're very much like, we're a part of, and think that our story about this focus on the parties speaks to that. Because going back to Schatzschneider and what political scientists find themselves in a kind of uphill battle talking to students and to readers, making the case for political parties. Political scientists are more pro-party than normal people, typically, for this reason, that because they're the only actors out there collectively organizing to take control of the government, they're the actors that are there to be held collectively responsible for what government does. And so they're the key bridge between individual, atomized voters out there and what the government does. They are bringing people into a kind of common cause, mobilizing them to participate in politics, simplifying the choices so it makes your actual choice meaningful. And in the process of doing, and then you can hold actual people accountable in government and throw the bums out or reward them for good governance. In the process of doing that, in democracies, parties are they're like teaching the lessons of forbearance, mutual toleration, win some, lose some. We have a vision, but it's a partial vision, and we know at some point we're going to lose, and you just got to play by the rules of the game. Once you have a party like the modern Republican Party that is eroding its capacity to act in that way, you open up space for much more dangerous and anti-democratic elements.
And further, on the same point, when Martin Van Buren created the modern mass party in the early 19th century, ancestor of today's Democratic Party, his very, very explicit goal was to prevent demagogy on the principle that when individuals limited their ambition and harnessed it to the support of a party that was larger than they were, that would then provide a check against tyranny. When the party is serving the individual, then you don't have that check against tyranny. So that is, in a sense, how Martin Van Buren is speaking to our present moment in various ways.
So, Will, so just, you know, to be clear and to rephrase a little bit what you said, the consequences of this are not equal, right?
Right.
I mean, in terms of what, and we'll get to the moment we're in, I guess, in a bit. But I do, because the book is in you know, it goes from, you know, roughly the sort of age of Jackson, you know, to the present, and we taught, and there are just examples, you know, a plenty of parties, and I just want to mention one of the rich things about this book is it identifies so many different strands of within parties that go throughout, that kind of recur throughout history. There, you know, there's the, just to name a couple, there's a policy reform strand that's much more focused on programs and policies. There's an accommodationist strand that we here in, you know, Philly will recognize pretty well. It's the kind of machine, it's the machine strand, the job boning, the favors traded for favor, and these kinds of they're present in many different political parties throughout history, and sometimes all of them are present in, you know, in one particular project, but. You know, one of the key things is the 19th century, right? And I just think it's worth delving into some of the examples that you talk about in the 19th century of, you know, really mass party experience. I mean, I wonder if it's just worth talking about, like, what, you know, and you can, whatever sort of project you want to, that you think is most illustrative, you know, what is like a, what's an example of a, you know, a big, what Tocqueville would describe as a great party, you know, just doing.
Start with a small party, then do a great party.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. So, yeah. Yeah, so we do, we evoke, Tocqueville made a distinction between great parties and small parties. He was writing in the Jacksonian era and thought that America, the great democracy, couldn't produce great parties. They produced kind of small-minded, patronage-driven, a lot of torchlight parades, but no big ideas, no grand ideologies, no grand projects. But we also give due to the power of, as you say, the accommodationist strand and the pioneers of mass party politics in the world were, we pay a lot of attention to Martin Van Buren, fellow upstate New Yorker, who was a, you know, son of a tavern keeper from upstate New York, ended up building a out of a faction of Jeffersonians in the early 19th century, ended up building up political power in the state of New York, known as the Albany Regency, and pioneered a lot of the kind of key building blocks that came to be the model of 19th century politics, which is very civically rooted at the local level, with kind of layers of hierarchical power, eventually the elaboration of networks of patronage and kind of material incentives that made the whole thing go, a commitment to the party and program over the man, over the kind of subsuming individual ambition into a party project. And Van Buren was the architect of a sectional, to be clear, this is why there are no, there's no golden age. We are not advocating a return to any particular party formation, least of all in the 19th century, least of all the Democratic Party project on behalf of a kind of sectional coalition of Southerners and Northern Jeffersonians, like Van Buren's project party on behalf of Andrew Jackson's presidential campaign in 1828. The Jacksonian era was the first era of parties as mass spectacle, parties as mobilizers of huge amounts of political participation among those who could vote. It was the arrival of universal white manhood suffrage, to evoke a real paradox. And it was on behalf of the white man's republic. It was a kind of explicitly violent imperial on the continent. This is the party that, and the president was Van Buren, who oversaw the Trail of Tears. A commitment to keeping slavery off the national agenda on behalf of this, but in the course of pursuing that project, they built all of the a key set of institutions that are with us today, the Quadrennial National Convention of State Party Delegates, to devise a national platform and nominate a candidate for president. That is a product of the Jacksonian era.
And then, as the second party system of the Jacksonian era dissolves, the United States actually sees a great party, and they are, in some sense, the heroes of this book, and that's the Republican Party of its founding generation. And what's important, the political project of which was to fight a civil war that saves the Union, frees the slaves, and then builds Reconstruction, puts equality in the Constitution, and that, in a sense, the best thing we've ever done as a country is the party project of the Republican Party. Now, to be clear, this is not a unified party. This is a party that is divided and factional, that has a radical wing with people like Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens, that has got plenty of moderates and conservatives, that is in hock to a lot of the elements of Northern capital, and, crucially, even as it is a party that is doing really, really, really big things, is also very, very much a 19th century party that is rooting its work in the day-to-day operations of patronage and small politics. There's a wonderful book from 1943 we read called Lincoln and the Patronage that shows just how, down to fourth-class postmasters, the Republican Party was very careful to put all of its allies in appointments, gave newspaper editors, big figures in the 19th century, jobs as consuls all around the world, and that this is very much a 19th century party, even if it is a party that is doing really world historical stuff.
So it was, in other words, this kind of republic, the great, you know, Republican Party project of the mid 19th century and, you know, post Civil War era was distinctly a party project.
Yes,
right. It was,
yes,
like it was a political party, and they, in order to get a lot of the things done that it needed to get done on behalf of the, you know, these epochal transformations,
right,
the ending of slavery, the defeating the South, it also needed to give jobs to
fourth-class postmasters.
And it was, I mean, and Reconstruction, which ends up being redeemed and crushed, was itself, that was a crash party-building project motivated both by the radical strand, the radical faction of Republicans at the height of their power in Congress, and motivated by raw electoral, kind of existential electoral considerations, because they needed to try and build up a Republican power in the occupied South before the South returns to Congress with more representation than ever, because you've got, you don't have the three-fifths clause anymore post-emancipation. And those motivations are kind of circulating around at the same time you have a truly powerful and revolutionary radical force within that same party.
Adelbert Ames, who was the carpetbagger governor of Mississippi, presiding over this biracial party in which recently enslaved people are playing a leading role, talks about my healing art, patronage. There's 19th century politics for you.
So just because, well, I'm one of the kind of questions that comes up with, you know, certainly with regards to the Democratic Party today, or, you know, or I mean, it comes up throughout parties, is like there are too many different things going on. There's too many there. It actually had, you know, you have Bernie Sanders and Joe Manchin, or you have, you know, and you like was the Republican Party functionally different? I mean, how did it manage? Did it have those contradictions? How did it manage them? I mean, what?
This is a party with very, very deep contradictions, and contradictions that during the Civil War are largely but not entirely sublimated, and then with Reconstruction, and this is, in a sense, retelling Reconstruction history rather than telling party story, the conflict inside Northern Capital, inside the engine room of the Republican Party, come to the fore, because what we call the pro-capital strand, the leading force of Northern industry, do not want to pay for an ongoing federal military occupation of the South, which is what's going to be required if you want to. They are not interested in massive land redistribution, which would disturb the cotton economy. They are not interested in giving labor contracts to Southern laborers that would then make Northern workers desirous of the same thing. And so if you're wondering, what happens to Reconstruction? What are the limits? They are, in many ways, the limits of this Republican Party project.
Which is to say, kind of across the book, we talk about a bunch of distinct, and we emphasize how fundamentally there is no, you know, in terms of what political scientists trying to come up with models of what parties are, on whose behalf do parties act, there is no one single model. There's a whole set of totally historically contingent formations. And there's no final victory in factional politics as much as there's no final victory in democratic politics. There's no equilibrium that's achieved. They all have these different strands and different actors working together for periods and papering over tensions that then manifest and become impossible to paper over. It's the same thing with the New Deal coalition across the middle of the 20th century. That's all.
We've just gotten very deep into the 19th century. I want to make a much more general point, which is the United States has got two parties. We've had basically two parties since the get-go. For reasons of the Electoral College, you need to get absolute majority in the Electoral College to elect a president, what political scientists call first-past-the-post elections. There is one and only one winner of elections for up and down the ticket. And so in this big, wild, diverse country that has got two parties, those parties are always going to be coalitions, and therefore you have very different tendencies that in a system with proportional representation, which most democracies have, would be separate parties in the United States are under the same party roof, and that creates interesting kinds of tensions, and in a sense, that's where we're off to the races in the book.
And we may get to this, but one thing that is actually interesting about our current moment is actually the parties are in fact probably more unified internally than they were. But one of the reasons we get there is the rise and fall of the new, what is called not just by you, but the New Deal order, right? And I think we all have a sense, I mean, of what that is, but I think it's worth spelling out here in, you know, in the terms of your book, like what was it that came together? And then, you know, because it seems like it plays a really fundamental role in the moment we're in right now, and at least in the book as you tell it, like, What was that project, you know, and how did it kind of fall apart? And then I think we'd want to get into where it leaves us here.
Okay, well, to make a long story short, you know, this is the Roosevelt's New Deal is not quintessentially at first a party project. He's got base of support in Congress among Republican progressives, a lot of his aides, his vice president originally was a former Republican progressive. They're radicals and socialists all as part of the kind of popular front that's pushing this. You get eventually a talk about internal contradictions. You have a what becomes the American version of a kind of social democratic project among Northern Democrats with organized labor and particularly the CIO once it emerged in the mid-1930s as the kind of social movement that's anchoring this project, married to a political party that still has this substantial block of Southern Democrats who are in Congress, empowered by the seniority system, so have a kind of disproportional influence, that are both committed to white supremacy, virulently opposed to organized labor in part as a result of their commitment to white supremacy, but are on board for other parts of the kind of developmental project of the New Deal. Over the course of the middle of the 20th century, the Democratic Party as an electoral party is a juggernaut because you have, as Ira Katznelson, a political scientist, once put it, it's a marriage of Sweden and South Africa, the old South Africa, of this very ideologically Frankenstein kind of coalition of a solid South of some of the most right-wing elements in American politics and a social democratic, urban-based, labor-based Northern Party. It's a constellation of organized labor at its kind of peak, capitalism at its most sort of managed and after World War II kind of protected for a while from the forces of globalization, and it's in the shadow of that New Deal order. You have a Republican Party that in various ways is kind of tamed and operates as the moon party to the sun party of Democrats, to quote Samuel Lubell. And it's the unraveling of that in the 1970s that proves to be so pivotal. It's precisely because the New Deal order kind of organizes a kind of constellation of interests that is so powerful that the unraveling of that in the 1970s proves a kind of critical juncture for our story.
So, it's worth pointing out, we're talking about big historical forces as well here. Parties can't just do everything on their own. And right. So there's the rise of stagflation, the globalization, et cetera. These things have a material effect. But one thing that, and this is sort of starts to bring us to the present day, is you talk about the rise of this, well, what's called, the advocacy explosion in the 70s. This is kind of like a granular thing. And then what ultimately is you describe as a para-party blob. What is that? What is the blob? Yeah, what is the blob? And why is it bad? Why is the blob bad?
So in the 1960s and 1970s, as the federal government starts to do more and more stuff with the Great Society and then continuing through the Nixon administration, there comes civil rights legislation. There's Medicare and Medicaid. There's federal government's getting involved in urban mass transit, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. All of this different activity is then created by and creating different kinds of actors, first especially on the left, then in emulation on the right, that are working outside formal party channels and trying to get what they want out of government in some way. And often that means through the courts as well as through legislatures, working through executive agencies. And so all these folks want something out of government, and they are not. Initially, this came at the same time as the decline of traditional state and local parties. Machines are on hard times. They're reform, liberal, democratic. Sometimes adversaries are also on hard times. It just means that politics seems to be a big mess. And then over time, those groups coalesce into relatively more stable Democratic and Republican orbits. Those orbits, in turn, are not accountable as parties are to electorates. They are funded by whether it's very rich people or mass folks through direct mail. They are trying to use whatever source of power around the political system they can find rather than looking to electoral politics. And so the blob is this vast, this is foundations, this is pools of 501c4, 527 money, all these different actors working outside party politics, but trying to get things from government that are increasingly important in understanding who actually is wielding power in what we would call writ large party politics. And the observation that these folks are around is, in a sense, not original. But a lot of political scientists have talked about networked parties and said, oh, it's so great that all these different actors are part of a network. And we are, in a sense, pointing to the dark side for electoral accountability of what we see in the blob.
Yeah, and just to be practical, we're talking about single-issue advocacy groups, ideological advocacy groups, think tanks, media entities. This is where asymmetries in the two parties start to rear. Like, there's a media presence in the Republican Party blob that is quite pronounced and important in a way that you don't see on the left. But foundations, all of these entities that, as Danny said, because of polarization, over time they've sorted themselves into one or two orbits, but they're not in and part of formal parties.
So the Republicans. Let's talk about the Republicans. I work with them. This is a partisan event, but just for the context of discussion, they control my life. In some ways, they control the majority in my chamber. The Republican story that you tell is, and this, there's a particular chapter that's called The Long New Right, which is like just about, you know, I think in particular about some of this para-party activity, mm-hmm. really, really seizing hold of the Republican Party. And it, you know, in part explains Trump not as a sort of fully new phenomenon, although there's much that's new, but as driving from this history. You write that the vision of the new right was vision less of party than a partisan majority. And I'm going to ask you to explain that difference in a second. But just also, there's a particular style that you identify with the new right, which I'd like you to talk about, and it is being critically important. And it involves all this activity. So if you could just kind of talk about, you know, what the new right wanted and how did it get it?
So to say something very briefly about academic ease, we sometimes academics like to say the long something, and so we got into this game here by saying the long new right, which is as an intervention, the new right, as it's often referred to, is about actors in the 1970s that we end up focusing a lot on. But we extended that to say that, in fact, there's a recurring style, an approach to party, an approach to politics that you can trace back to the early post-war conservative movement. And that approach was preoccupied with mobilizing electoral coalitions on the basis of conflict and resentments, and an approach to politics and party that was always quite mercenary, instrumental. There was no commitment to building up organizations or institutions as something valuable in itself that you would want to continue. They would kind of wage their fights wherever it was most easy to do so at the moment. And we start with people like Joe McCarthy. Obviously, lots of people have talked about Joe McCarthy and McCarthyism. But the thing about Joe McCarthy as a political figure was how kind of, and the people around him, how gonzo and performatively bullying he was, how much he didn't himself, he talked much more about pinstripe State Department elitists engaging in vicious kind of homophobic rhetoric about this kind of lavender menace out in Washington, much more than he would talk about anything about geopolitics and the communist threat. And the broader conservative posture towards McCarthy for a significant amount of time, up to including William F. Buckley, the editor of National Review, who wrote a book about McCarthy, was this kind of what we call anti-anti discourse, where they wouldn't go in for defending McCarthy directly, but they would go after the people who were carping and getting all their feathers ruffled about his tactics. They said, no, you need to you need to recognize a common front here, but it was a way of evading ever having to take responsibility for that kind of action. That the Long New Right continues through the kind of very permeable borders between mainstream movement conservatism organized around places like the National Review and more fringe elements, John Birch Society, other kind of grassroots conservative organizations, early Christian organizations in the 50s and 60s that were virulently anti-communist and right-wing. That carries all the way through the 1960s, the organization of groups like the Young Americans for Freedom, who kind of aped the campus left in gonzo performative tactics on campuses. And the breakthrough does come in the generation of the 1970s with people like Paul Weyrich, Richard Viguerie, who build a set of organizations outside of the former Republican Party, pioneering things like direct mail, issue coalitions around all these new issues that have been kicked up out of the social movements in the 1960s. So anti-feminism, eventually a pro-life movement, busing, etc. They build up, taking advantage of new campaign finance regulations. They build up para-party organizations, political action committees. This is in the 70s where they build up all these new explicitly ideological think tanks that surround the Republican Party, that explicitly, as you allude to, they thought about replacing the Republican Party. They wrote Bill Rusher from the National Review wrote a book calling for a new Republican Party, a new conservative party that would turn the Republican Party into the Whigs and the dustbin of history and unite a conservative and kind of Wallace coalition. But eventually, the kinds of politics they're doing, the kinds of issue coalitions they're putting together, become what the Republican Party as an electoral vehicle is by the time you get to the 80s and Reagan.
Well, it's just to move to the present. This is a story much more of continuity than change on the right. And so when Sam and I look at Charlie Kirk and Ben Shapiro and ads for precious metals and multi-level marketing, and people say, where did this come from? He says, oh, yeah, this is all familiar. We've seen this stuff before.
Well, and Brent Bozell III?
The fourth
was a January 6th. He got arrested on January 6th. You're going to know this better. Who's the one who wrote McCarthy and his critics with?
Grandpa.
Okay, his grandpa co-wrote the book about McCarthy with William F. Buckley. His father was a right-wing critic of the liberal media. And, you know, the generations continue. It's a beautiful thing.
So as, you know, one thing that's key is that, you know, one of the key figures of the new right, he's upheld by the new right, Ronald Reagan, who loses in 76, comes close to winning the nomination in 76,
right.
Wins the nomination and the presidency. They flip the Senate. The Republicans flip the U.S. Senate and Democrats lose a bunch of House seats in 80, landslide election in 84, and they win the election in 1988. Three straight national electoral losses with some midterm gains in between that for the Democrats, but three straight losses. They're in disarray. There's a statistic you mentioned about how little money they're raising,
yeah,
as well. Were they in 92 they were still paying off their campaign debt from 68?
In the early 80s.
They
early
were still
80,
paying off campaign debt from like almost 20 years ago. So I mean but they fixed that, right? The Democrats. So actually the parallel story for the Democrats is they lose all these elections, and I mean it's not just in response, but in partly in response, they change as well, right? The New Deal coalition has fallen apart. What happens to my party?
So there are a bunch of different storylines that are going on. The first is the relentless march of polarization. That is to say, the old Southern Democrats who are a part of this party with links back to Civil War times, white Southern Democrats leave the party, moderate Northeastern Republicans become Democrats, and so the parties separate ideologically, and the once very, very numerous conservative Democrats, who essentially are the folks who enact the Reagan agenda in 81, are no longer Democrats by the end of this period. And that's just the drumbeat of the last 40 years and how the party becomes more liberal. Meanwhile, there's a rise and fall story, and that is of what we might call neoliberalism, and in a much more practical way, is the party faction of New Democrats who want to yank the party away from organized labor and Jesse Jackson, move it to the center. These are the motivating actors behind welfare reform. They are in favor of financial deregulation, and they have their moment in the 1980s and 1990s. Liberals are really on the back foot in intellectual discourse in a lot of this period. There's attempts to move in the other direction. And then after about 2000, that movement goes in the other direction. And so you no longer have the kind of back and forth of polarization and neoliberalism moving in opposite directions. And that's how, since the early 2000s, party's been moving much more uniformly up to, let's say, 2020 in a leftward direction, including in the 2010s, you're a living experience of this, a real left faction in ways that would have been unimaginable for most of the post-war period. And finally, in along these other two, starting in the 1980s, there's someone named Tony Coelho, who's the chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, who really helps Democrats to discover how to raise money. He's the chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and one of the events did already was to talk with a bunch of Democratic campaign chiefs, and this was in a little townhouse a block from Capitol Hill, and there are the campaign chiefs, and there are some of their friends who've gone through the revolving door, the head of public affairs at UPS, with the lobbyists, drinking wine, learning about hollow parties, and this is the fruits of what Tony Coelho does. And then in more recent decades, you get, and this is Political Action Committee's medium dollar donors, then you get really big money, dark money, Silicon Valley money, and so Democrats, in a sense, get the monkey's paw of, you say you wanted money, you've got money, and that has advantages in being able to be generously funded and disadvantages in there's ample money and very little incentive to organize. I think Sam has a quote somewhere.
Well, this goes back to the origins of all this, but shows the recurring problem here, because as Dan just alluded to, it is a struggle of the whole being less than the sum of its parts, and some very much, particularly in the 80s and 90s, kind of cross currents. There are financial exigencies. They are way behind in just the core question of how you finance elections, and the way they get themselves out of that comes with a whole lot of negative consequences for what the kind of clouded vision is of that party. But we opened the chapter on the Democrats since 1981 with a Democratic National Strategy Council meeting in September 1981 after Reagan's election the year before. And Alan Cranston of California is chairing a conversation among Democrats, and they have a question that they put forth to kick off this conversation in 1981. If our party is a coalition, unlike the Republicans who tend to represent a single group, what are the common denominators transcending regional differences and local interests which makes us a national party? The Republicans cannot and will not represent the needs and hopes of middle and lower income Americans as we are committed to do. Yet numbers of these Americans voted Republican in 1978 and 1980. How have we failed to make clear that the Democratic Party represents the true interests of these and other Americans among our true constituencies? I mean, these continue to be
all these trajectories we're talking about, but those are the questions that are still in every time Democrats lose. We are asking those same questions.
And we are asking it right now because people are terrified that they're going to lose in November.
So with that, I am going to open it up to questions.
My knowledge of the true inner workings of Donald Trump's mind, my knowledge is not sufficient, but I'm just imagining he's in front of a wildly enthusiastic throng, and it is set up so that certain questions can be put to him. And someone asks him, how do you feel about what Franklin Roosevelt did during the Depression? What would be your guess as his genuine internal response, and would it be something that he'd be able to put to words, true to those feelings, in a situation like that? Or,
I mean,
would he hold back? I mean, sometimes he really lets the shit out. What's your guess as to his true feeling and knowledge of what went on then, how would he view it?
I have no idea if he has a true feeling or any knowledge of the 30s. What he would not do, though, and what he certainly, importantly never did in 2016, is repeat a critique of Roosevelt and the New Deal on kind of pristine free market grounds, which there was a boomlet. What's her name?
Amity Schleis.
Amity Schleis had a best-selling book in the kind of Tea Party era, reviving the reputation of Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover, and describing how the New Deal is what prolonged the Depression. Donald Trump would never do that.
One of my favorite minor archival discoveries was Charles Koch praising that book in his quarterly newsletter column to Koch Industries employees.
Which is to say that in a completely non-programmatic and feral way, Trump reads his audience and had a beat on the Republican Party base and what they do or don't actually care about and prioritize that was much more astute than what it is that Republican elites and the kind of leading lights of the conservative movement had thought by 2016. The kinds of organizations and actors that were pursuing a Paul Ryan agenda, you know, in Congress and in government, Trump sniffed out the huge gap between what that was and what it is Republican base voters wanted. And so he ran on, obviously, a ton of red meat about building a wall and making Mexico pay for it and banning Muslims from the country. He also ran pledging to not touch Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid and pay for a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. And he hinted that he'd, you know, raise taxes on hedge funders. And most of it was lies, but it was, you know, that would be the kind of themes I would imagine would come up if he could place Roosevelt in the 30s.
We talk about the polarization today and being at an extreme, and I guess as knowledgeable people of our history, is that really true? Is it or just that as a perception? Because of my amateurish knowledge of history, it was pretty bitter for many, many years. The first 150 years, you go back to Adams and Jefferson, you go back to pre-Civil War, it was pretty bitter and elections were pretty dangerous then too. And so I was just wondering, are we just being extra sensitive because of the media that it's more polarized today than it has been in the past? I was just curious to your thoughts.
I guess I'll talk my old book. Your historical references are on point. I think today is, you know, has resonances with the 1790s and, you know, hopefully not too much, but with the 1850s. Those are very particularly polarized moments where it's not just that there's partisan rancor and zesty competition, but fundamental conflicts in society seem to be reflected and aligned with the two parties. And what you did have over the course of the second half of the 20th century is this, with the central story being going on in the South, but not only in the South, this long ideological sort of the two parties on not just new kind of cultural issues that emerge from the 60s onward, but core questions about political economy going back to the New Deal with the rise of Republicans in the South and the end of the Solid South, et cetera. And that meant that in the last several decades, the parties just do programmatically stand for much more distinct things than they used to. Now, I will say interesting things are going on in the last 4 or 5 years. There's just an article by David Leonhardt in the New York Times about the rise of a new kind of, he called centrism, which I think confuses matters, but there's a rise of new kinds of bipartisan lawmaking happening right now that you could broadly say represents a kind of post-neoliberal turn that involves both a much more ramped up competition with China that gets more people interested in new trade restrictions and industrial policy. And that is a story and part of the forces that Trump represents on a kind of programmatic level, broadly speaking, shaking things up and kind of disrupting what had become a pretty pristinely polarized situation. Danny, you spoke to David Leonard.
What I said was that as Republican base voters have been interested in, and as those who are looking for Trump's favor have been obsessed with, election conspiracies, the really gonzo stuff, that on bread and butter lawmaking, like it or not, there's actually more room for compromise than there was in the Barack Obama and Paul Ryan staring them down era,
yeah,
which was also a period when Republicans were not as, when the certification of elections was not in the kind of doubt that we now might place it in, and that is a really important paradox of this weird moment in which we find ourselves.
Thank you. So I've heard about this like idea of this kind of like strategy of electoral politics called populism. It's associated with David Shore. I think Matthew Iglesias are two commentators that tend to push for it. It's like kind of the idea of like, maybe, sounds like you guys are familiar with this, so maybe you'll explain it better than I can, but something around the lines of like, talk about things that are popular. I think like John Fetterman is an example of a candidate who won their election kind of in using this populist framework. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about that. Like, how does it fit with what you are talking about? Is the idea of populism generally correct or not based on what you've seen? But we'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
So we are not being factional, and therefore we are not getting in a fight between our friend Matt Iglesias, who had a book event in D.C. for us and is in a different factional place from our friend Nikhil Saval, who is having a book event for us right here. And not only do we not want to see our friends fight, but the purpose of this book is not to make factional war, but to see so that people, wherever they are on the spectrum, and we did at one point, sort of early on, say we are something like proud and loyal, if oft disillusioned Democrats, and that's as much as you're getting from us, that they can see their own political dilemmas and the possibilities and limits of what they are trying to do in historical light, in light of a world in which they are not going to achieve total victory over their foes, but will have to fight and fight and fight and accept partial victories. All that extensive throat clearing aside, popularism is, on the one hand, to me, Sam, I think speaking more sort of first person singular than in most of what we've been saying tonight, correct in its fundamentally what we would call accommodationist, a sort of machine-like interest in meeting voters where they are and in doing politics in ways that accept the limits of what's possible. I think that popularists place more faith in public opinion polling as a way to determine large-scale priorities than we might, that voters respond to a complicated set of circumstances on the ground. Politicians have to make programs, devise policies with uncertain effects. So are Biden's tariffs against China popular? You know, most people don't know what they are. A great power war with China would be really unpopular if that's what it's going to lead to. People might like the idea of tariffs against the bad guys, but they also don't want to pay high prices. And we're seeing that voters really, really, really don't like inflation. And so you begin to unpeel the popularist onion and things get complicated. Should you do, if you are running in a close race, should you take a high-profile, highly unpopular stand on an issue? No, that's in a sense, political malpractice. And a lot of the core of popularism to restate doing politics right seems eminently sound. Yeah. When this becomes an ism like liberalism or conservatism, then I sort of start looking askance and saying, I'm not sure you can quite go there with the data you've got.
I endorse all that. Without having worked out an answer in advance, I think that's all right. Like, there's a kind of polling literalism, to use another ism, that I think one should avoid. Doing this book has made me much more appreciative of the tradition, the virtues of organized party politics and an approach to party politics that starts with a kind of what are ways we can suss out what voters think and feel, and how do we speak to that and mobilize people on that basis. And I think rather than just getting a couple wizards who are great at looking at polls that can do certain things, but just there's just so much to politics and policymaking that polling is not going to tell you. But giving more of a voice, and not ever fooling yourself into thinking that you can ignore voting public opinion or ignore voters' wishes or where you are in space, in places and localities, and do politics effectively. That's important to try and revive, particularly just trying to organize elected officials to who are the ones who still have the most existential, like they have to get reelected, and they have various ways of attempting to try and figure out how to do that. Some of it involves a lot of it involves polling, but it's not just polling. They are a kind of in the growth of the blob and in a very polarized era, that kind of like political wisdom is, I think, has in some ways fallen into low ebb in a way that I don't think is useful. And to that extent, you know, I share the impulse of the populists, like the person who introduced us, Matt Iglesias.
So, as an elected official, I also like getting reelected. I appreciate that, and I want to appreciate also just the spirit of this, which is the project of the, or rather the spirit of investing parties and with meaning and with building political projects that, you know, on which many things depend, including the fate of this country perhaps. And so to that end, I hope you can join me in thanking and re-welcoming our authors Sam and Dan and Danny to Philadelphia. And
thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.